It's time to think big with Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and No Good Lying Through Your Tooth, Tall Alaska Tales. It's the Big Alaska Show. Broadcasting from the studios of a remote cabin outside Bolchitna and streamed worldwide at KFQD.com with podcasts streamed at BigAlaskaShow.com. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steven, some Big Alaska Show friends. It's part two of our 1964 Alaska Earthquake Special Edition of the Big Alaska Show. We're featuring author, historian, and Seward resident Doug Capra. And a gold nugget memory with broadcast legend Herb Shainland. Designed to raise your spirits, not your blood pressure, unless you're a guy named Mike Ford. Good morning, everyone. It's the Big Alaska Show.
And good morning and welcome to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Uncle Steve, along with my good buddy and co-host Mike Ford. Today, we're doing our part two of our 1964 Good Friday earthquake. Because we had so much stuff last week, and we had leftover stuff for this week, we've got an interview with Doug Capra, our author, historian, and Seward resident. And Doug Capra wrote this article called The Luxury of Forgetting, The Town of Seward After the 1964 Good Friday Alaska Earthquake, about the week after the earthquake and how they responded to it. Of course, he's a historian and gets into the weeds on it, so I had to
pull him out of the weeds.
Yeah, well, we've got to pull them out of the weeds. The stories that come out of that now are from the children that were in it.
Right. Well, and it was one of the most prepared cities up here, wasn't it? Because of all the stuff they'd been doing to be an all-American city.
They were prepared because of civil defense due to the missile crisis that took place in the early 1960s. It's an amazing story, and it's amazing the devastation that happened to Seward and how they came out of it.
Right.
But anyway, these are the stories we're going to be talking about today. I was looking at Richter scale, the rating the power of an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
So the earthquake we had in 2018, that was a 7.2, as I recall. And in our last week's show, one of the clips we aired was when you shared the story about your car bumping up and down.
Yes. I thought it was my wife and her daughter out there shaking the car. And then the front end started going up and down. I go, no, it's not them. And then all those people come spilling out into the morning with half clothed. And I thought, okay, something else is going on here.
We had just boarded that 737. And I remember the plane tipping way to the left, almost where the wing was hitting the ground and back to the other side. So I was doing research on Richter scale. 7.0 and higher is considered catastrophic.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess that earthquake, that 7.2, lasted maybe, 30 seconds maybe, or it seemed like a long time for an earthquake.
Well, they're still repairing a lot of the Eagle River homes that were damaged. Even to this day, there's been repairs going on and some that were just hopeless after that out there. That was, for real estate, that was a big hit for Eagle River.
Yeah. And so I was looking at... The difference between a 7.0 and a 6.0.
Every decimal is 100 times, I believe, is what Don Hartman shared with us back in the day.
Okay. So an 8.0 is 10 times stronger than a 7.0 and 100 times stronger than a 6.0.
Yeah.
But anyway, it talked about by the time you get to the 8.9 or to the difference between the 8 and the 9, it's like 1,083 times stronger than a 7.0. So ours lasted, 30 seconds?
Mm-hmm.
And that was considered potentially catastrophic.
Oh, yeah. It was the aftershocks that were nerve-wracking, though. That was the...
Now, we missed those. We got out of town. So you experienced that. When we go back to the 1964 earthquake, that lasted almost 5 minutes at 9.2.
Wow.
When I went back, started listening to some of these interviews, they talk about the aftershocks. And the aftershocks you experienced, probably very similar, were some of about as strong as the 7.2 you felt?
They sure felt like it, but I think everybody was still, because you have some people who are finely attuned to any sort of vibration, like my wife, and that's
It's kind of like you get a tuning fork and kind of twang, hit it with a spoon. And it was just like, okay, here we go again.
Yeah. They have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of aftershocks, many of which were about as intense as the initial earthquake. So in going back and listening to the show, but listening to Doug Capper's interview, there's something in it that he talks about it in is sort of the aftermath when people finally after they started getting, you know, they were getting settled into being about a week or so later, there's one of the comments they talked about is almost a depression. And he calls it a post-traumatic stress where they've been operating on adrenaline for so long.
Right.
That they finally actually are sitting down really starting to realize what they've just gone through.
It's kind of like Mother Nature just waged war on us, you know?
Yeah. So we have Doug Capra. We pulled out Tim Sullivan, a good buddy of mine and a longtime Alaskan, talk about his experience. And then, of course, we brought out our little gold nugget memory with broadcast legend Herb Shainlin, talking about his thing. And
something I've forgotten about that, about Herb, you know, because I was his director for many years on the Hotline show in the evening on KFQD.
Right.
And whenever we did have an earthquake, he'd be kind of rattled. And so, you know, after hearing his experience in the big one, I can understand that. And that really never crossed my mind until I was saying, wow, he's really unnerved by this, whatever, this 4 point something.
We moved up about a year after the earthquake. I could tell which students had been through the earthquake because anytime we had a shaker, they were the first ones to the door jam.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Oh, man. So anyway, today is our Big Alaska Show Part 2 special edition of the 1964 Good Friday earthquake.
And of course, Mike, we'd be remiss if we didn't start the Big Alaska Show out the right way. We still got our coffee.
Folks, the trick to doing a radio show, especially an early Saturday morning radio show, is a strong cup of coffee. That's why we here at the Big Alaska Show drink Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning indigestion. If there's one thing co-host Mike Ford's decades of broadcast experience has taught him, it's how to make a powerful cup of joe. And when it comes to that, Big Alaska Show does not disappoint. Just one sip of this steaming pile of swill cuts through the very bottom of your core to create a rictal rumbling burst of energy that makes a great Alaska earthquake seem like an almost harmless silent one-cheek sneak. Bitter biting with a specific gravity of basalt. Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning gas.
Pour me a cup, it's time to get up and face the world, my friend. Pour me a cup, I can't get enough for that Big Alaska Show Blend.
That's how we roll here at the Big Alaska Show. But stick around, we have more Big Alaska Show coming up. And you can hear our show streamed and get podcasts at bigalaskashow.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
Today's show is our part two of our Big Alaska Show special edition of the Big Alaska Show 1964 Good Friday Earthquake. You can listen to last week's part one by going to our podcast, which you can find on our website at bigalaskashow.com. We've been pulling out interviews from our past shows of people who lived through the Good Friday earthquake, and so the quality of sound varies as it does over the years. In this interview, our guest is Tim Sullivan Sr., a longtime friend. The Sullivans are a multi-generational Alaskan family, and Tim was the oldest son of the George and Margaret Sullivan family. I was on the road, and Tim came into the KFQD studio, and here is his story.
Tim Sullivan is the big brother of the Sullivan clan. And I discovered why Dan was able to throw me into a basketball hamper when we were in the ninth grade. It's because he was schooled by his bigger, stronger brothers. Let's give a warm Big Alaska Show welcome to Tim Sullivan.
That's right, Steve. That's absolutely right.
That, yeah, you taught your brother well.
I did.
Yes.
All my brothers.
Hey, listen, thanks for being so patient and standing by. It's really interesting to hear these stories. And where were you when it happened?
Well, I was at home, and, you know, being good Irish Catholics, we were fasting and abstaining that day. You know, it started about 5:30 and lasted for about 5 minutes, and it was the most terrifying thing I've ever been through in my life. It really was mounted to about 3 earthquakes, and they jolted each time with increasing ferocity, and the noise was just indescribable. It was as loud as anything I've ever heard in my life, and the house was creaking, and the dishes were rattling, and Mom's in the doorway yelling, "Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, assist me," and we're just hanging on for dear life.
Did you think it was a nuclear attack? I know a lot of people I've talked to thought it was.
That was the furthest thing from my mind. My mind was just hanging onto that door frame to keep from getting thrown around.
Were the other kids in? Because, you know, you got a pretty good sized family, although it was probably a little smaller then, but still.
Yeah, there were only 7 of us then. and, you know, they were hanging on for dear life as well. In fact, later on, we figured out one of my brothers, Kevin, whose birthday was that day, still is that day, was up in the alley with Benny Stevens, Ted Stevens' son, and they were hanging on to a telephone pole for dear life. And so then when the earthquake was over, that's the first thing we did was start counting heads, and we noticed that Kevin wasn't there, so we started looking for him, and he came bursting in the back door from the alley, and he was scared to death, of course, and,
sure.
You know, and we were just glad it stopped. And so then it was, trying to assess things, and of course, Dad wasn't home at the time. He was in Juneau in the legislature, and so, you know, I kind of had to take on the task of being halfway in charge, along with Mom, and so it was a tough time. Mom had a cake in the oven for Kevin, and that didn't get cooked all the way through, so she started cooking dinner in the fireplace, and the cake in there as well, and the cake came out about half burned, but we still had the opportunity to have birthday for Kevin that day. Even to this day, Kevin doesn't like to be here on his birthday. Right now, he's in the D.C. area. But in other years, he's always made it a point to leave the state before his birthday to not be here on that anniversary.
You know, what's that saying that you can't get a cat to get back on a hot stove, but you can't get it back on a cold one either?
No, that's right. So then in the subsequent days, you know, we didn't have any water, no sewer, no electricity, no heat. So we used the fireplace for heat, and the National Guard brought in water tanks for potable water. It was interesting times, and I really don't recall how long it took to get electricity back on. I think it was weeks, and the same with gas, and the same with water. Those things all took time for the crews to get together and start putting that stuff back together. It was interesting times, and of course, I was a sophomore at West at the time, and you know, the top floor of West High was completely obliterated, and luckily, we weren't in school because it was Good Friday, and you know, following years, or actually following weeks, then we double shifted over at East High School for a couple of months. I really don't remember how long it took to go back to school. I think it was at least 2 weeks, maybe even 3 weeks. We were enjoying the heck out of it because, you know, it was the longest spring break I ever had in my life while I was in school.
When you said you were getting food and water and all that stuff, who provided that? How'd that work?
You know, I really don't know.
Military.
Yeah, I mean, National Guard and the military were big parts of that.
Wow. Yeah.
And then actually, when it came to communication, the ham radio operators were a big factor in communication, letting people outside know and other family members know what was going on here. And that's kind of how my dad found out how we were doing. And then he didn't show up for a couple days afterwards just because there weren't any flights going in and out and people didn't know, you know, who was alive and who was dead. And I mean, there's a story for another time I'll tell about my dad when he was in the governor's office. But, you know, it was interesting, real interesting times. And a week later, almost to the time and definitely a week to the, there was another earthquake. And it was a big jolt. And man, we thought, man, we're going through it again. I mean, remember that as clear as a bell. That was a big, big shot.
I know they had all these aftershocks going on. I mean, it says for months. Do you remember that period? Because you went through many of them.
I mean, you had earthquakes all the time after that. It was, you know, and they all ranged in probably in the 4, 5, and 6 category, you know, ranges as far as intensity goes. I want to say one other thing about the ham radio operators. You know, to this day, they still get free driver's license plates. Or license plates for their cars because of the work that they did during the earthquake.
That's how we got our information, by the way. my mother's brother, he was up here. He was a geologist, and that's how we found out information, because all the information we received was Alaska's destroyed. And it's really interesting, because when you look at the deaths that actually came as a result of this, they're amazingly small for the kind of event this was. You know,
we know, I mean, there was an old family friend. He lived in Valdez, and when the news about the tsunami came, he went down to the Valdez dock with his two kids to go watch the tsunami come in. And, of course, you never found him, never saw him, never heard from him again after the tsunami hit in Valdez.
The information I read was, I mean, there was something like the wave that came in was 70 meters in Valdez. And not only was the tsunamis, but they also had where they had the undercurrents created, like Portage dropped, what, 3 meters? And what was the damage to your house? Do you remember?
Actually, pretty minimal. We were pretty fortunate. You know, the house shook like crazy, but, you know, later on we found some small cracks in the concrete block of the walls of the basement, and that was about it.
This goes to prove if a home can house as many Irish as your house, you know, it can put up with anything.
You're absolutely right about that, Steve.
When you think back on the earthquake, Tim, when you start reflecting back on it, what is the thing that just jumps out in your mind on this? I mean, what comes to your mind most when you think about it?
Well, total and abject fear.
I mean, I can't imagine 9.2.
And even then, it wasn't classified as 9.2. It was classified as 7.6 initially. And then, of course, they've changed the Richter scale since. But even at that point, it was still, you know, one of the largest earthquakes ever. You know, it still scares me to this day. I'm still shaking right now as we speak, Steve.
Yeah. Hey, listen. You should really be shaking, because anybody appears on the Big Alaska Show, they can tell you that their careers tank.
Good Stripling, thank you so much for the opportunity.
This is Mike Ford.
And I'm Uncle Steve, inviting you to join us for the Big Alaska Show Saturday mornings.
It's Big Alaska guests, adventures, and no good lying through your two tall Alaska tales.
And we're designed to raise your spirits, not your blood pressure. Just leave your muddy boots and politics at the door.
It's a great way to start your Saturday.
And we're locally owned, just like our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors and Alaska Enterprise Solutions.
For broadcast, streaming, and podcast information, visit BigAlaskaShow.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Alaska Enterprise Solutions. They're your authorized sales agent for Xerox in Alaska. Call Mike Ferris or visit him anytime at aesalaska.com.
Thanks for joining us on the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve here, along with co-host Mike Ford. Our interviews have centered on Alaskans and their personal experience with the Good Friday Alaska earthquake. Our next guest, Doug Capra, lives in Seward, Alaska, and is an author, historian, and journalist. In this interview, we talk about an article he wrote about Seward's response following the earthquake, for which they were awarded the All-American City designation. Our guest, Doug Capra, has been on the show before, more than once. And in fact, you'll find one of his books, The Spaces Between, Stories from the Kenai Mountains to the Kenai Fjords, on our Big Alaska Show book review section. Doug is not only, he's a Seward resident, been a longtime Seward resident, but he's an excellent author, he's a historian, and he's a really good journalist. He's written an interesting article called The Luxury of Forgetting, The Town of Seward After the 1964 Good Friday Alaska Earthquake. Would you please give a warm Big Alaska Show welcome to Doug Capra?
Thank you. Here's Johnny.
Yeah. Right. You need to have your son, Nate, make a little graphic of a hook coming to pull us off, you know.
I called it The Luxury of Forgetting because I first came to Alaska in 1971, and I came to Seward in 1972. And in those early years when I was in Seward, there were still a lot of people alive who were adults during the 1964 earthquake. And there were all kinds of stories, and there was a lot of talk about the earthquake. It was still there. As I've lived in Seward over the years, you know, through the 80s and through the 90s and the 2000s, the old timers, most of them have died off. There are still a few old timers in their 80s and 90s now that remember the earthquake as adults. Now it's mostly children, you know, that remember the earthquake. And some of them that were like in high school are my age now, 75. So we're losing, you know, the memory of it, the first person memory of it. And we used to have all kinds of commemorative events and everything. We don't have some anymore. So I thought that we can't afford the luxury of forgetting what happened during the earthquake. And not only the first few minutes of the earthquake and the first day, but what went on after that? What went on the second day? And what went on the third day and the fourth day? And then the week and the next week and the month? That recovery, as I did my research many years ago, talked to the survivors, that was an interesting story. And so I called it The Luxury of Forgetting. We can't afford to forget how we recovered, even in the first few days after the earthquake. And I wasn't there, of course. I was a high school kid back in Massachusetts. But that's the story.
People can read this article. If you go to bigalaskashow.com, we're going to carry it on our book review section. We're going to have a link to Doug's site as well, so you can read this. And we're going to be able to touch on just a little bit of it because it's fairly extensive. We've had a number of interviews, especially out of the Anchorage area, of people who were in the quake. But what caught me about your article was the civic and community response afterwards. Imagine if a 9.2 hit Anchorage, Alaska right now. I mean, we can't even deal with the snow. And how prepared Seward was for handling this. And it's a remarkable account. You know, you talk about the old generation dying off. Something I really appreciate about what you've done and the value of it, the journalism you've done over the years of encountering these firsthand experiences and recording them and really putting it in such a way that we experience it. It's just, I'm a big fan, Doug, of your work. You provide such a service to Alaska and the community of Seward. So I think you should be very proud of this stuff.
Yeah, well, I think it's important. The winters, you know, we know the winters in this part of Alaska, South Central, can be pretty harsh sometimes. A few years ago, we had a tsunami warning in, January or February, and the weather was terrible and everything. And I just began to think, you know, what would it be like if we had a 9.2 earthquake in the middle of the winter with a 30, 40 mile an hour wind and, you know, wind chill factors really low. And also when you think in Seward of the summer, when we've got all those RVs lined up along the shore. A few years ago, we had a tsunami warning, and they were able to evacuate most of those RVs from the shore. But I mean, I don't know how much time it took. The first tsunami in 1964 arrived about 20 minutes after the earthquake. And actually, there was an earlier wave before that. It's called a Secchi wave, a wave when the ground along the shore was displaced and fell into the bay. It created a wave that hit the other side of the bay and bounced back. So there was a first wave that came in very early on. But why was Seward so well prepared? That brings me back to 1924, an article I found in the paper in 1924. There was a visitor in Seward, and this was in February 1924, and there was a big earthquake, pretty big earthquake in 1924. And the visitor goes, wow, earthquake, earthquake. And the next morning, the Seward Gateway came out, and there was nothing about the earthquake. So he was surprised. He went to the Gateway. Why didn't you publish it? And the Gateway basically, you know, kind of laughed it off and said, you know, if a halibut schooner comes into Resurrection Bay, that's not a story at all. But if you see a halibut schooner coming up a river in Nebraska, that would be a story.
Yeah.
Basically, they said earthquakes aren't stories around where we get them all the time.
Yeah.
The reason Seward was so prepared, and by the way, I'm not just talking about Seward, other towns were prepared in Alaska too, was civil defense. You've got to remember back in the early 60s, there was Cold War going on. It wasn't that long ago between the Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay. Mm-hmm. So everybody was remembering that. And the big fear was that we were going to be hit by a nuclear weapon, and how do we survive? And so in most communities in Alaska, civil defense groups formed, and they were all ready for this. And so the first thing you see in Seward were the civil defense people coming in with plans. I mean, how do you feed people? You know, what about water and sewage?
Water. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Disease, you know, get those typhus shots. You know, the civil defense came in right away. They were planning all this stuff.
My parents built a fallout shelter. We had not moved to Alaska yet, and they built a fallout shelter. Eventually became where my brother's high school buddies would play poker, you know, but you grew up around this too. We would have drills
when I was in elementary school, how to prepare for a nuclear attack and how to cover up. We'd get under our desk and we'd cover
up. Duck and cover, they called it. Duck and cover. Yeah, we remember that. Yeah.
We came so close to having a nuclear war, probably the closest we've ever been.
Yeah, and, right. We remember that. And our parents certainly remembered that. And remember, there were still lots of World War II veterans around in 1964. I mean, there were still several World War I veterans around in 1964. Mm-hmm. And so those veterans, you know, remembered war. And the civil defense came right away. And then, of course, the press started to come to Seward. But you want to talk about that?
I do want to talk about the press a little later on. Originally, what I wanted to do is I wanted to start out going back to what the conversation you and I first started having is I was going to talk to you about how it became the All-American City. I had asked you, how did that come about? And you said, well, there are actually two. And so
actually three.
Now you tell me.
Well, no, you see, Anchorage has received four All-American City Awards over the years. Seward has received three. We received one for 1963 that we were going to celebrate in 1964. Then we got another one in 1965 because of recovery from the earthquake. And then we got another one in 2005. And there are other cities. In fact, what I find very interesting, the All-American City organization gives out 10 or 11 every year. Or they did in those days, 10 or 11 every year. In 1965, three Alaska cities got the award, Anchorage, Valdez, and Seward. And I just wonder, in the history of the All-American City Award, how many states ever got three awards in one year? I don't know if any of them other did, but we all got them, Anchorage, Valdez, and Seward, for our recovery efforts after the 64 earthquake. The one you're talking about is the one that we got in Seward got in 1963. And we learned about it in late winter of 1964. We learned that we got the award, but it was secret. Everybody in town was supposed to keep it a secret. What hadn't been released to the press yet? Well, you know, everybody in town knew about it.
Yeah.
But they were able to keep it a secret within Seward, pretty much. I think it didn't get out. Very interestingly enough, the award was announced. The Seward newspaper, the Petticoat Gazette, came out on March 26, Thursday, the day before the earthquake, announcing the All-American City Award. Now, why did we get the award? Well, I'm going to read just a little bit here from the article so you'll have it, okay? By 1961, much of the military had left town. Fish processing plants had closed, as well as a freight company, and other economic woes plagued the city. Seward, Alaska was, you know, named the All-American City Award for its recovery. And one newspaper wrote, instead of accepting their fate, the newspaper said, the citizens voted to pave the gravel streets while the town council put its entire capital investment budget for 1962, which was $34,000, into harbor improvement. Fish production improved by 60%. The Women's Club raised enough money to start a new library for the town. In this spirit, the newspaper wrote, is bringing industry back with two new businesses expected to open and 120 jobs and everything. And also in my book, The Spaces Between, there's an article about putting the Christmas tree up on the mountain, you know, the Christmas tree. That went up in 1961. In the midst of all kinds of personal tragedy, personal controversies that were going on.
Yeah.
City council members were recalled. City manager was fired and rehired. Teachers were fired because a new superintendent was brought in. There was a lot of animosity going on. I don't find a lot of writing about that as to why Seward got the award. They got the award for economic recovery and not giving up. And remember the Port of Whittier, don't forget. Seward got really hit hard when the Port of Whittier came in.
Let me step it back just a little bit. So the 63 All-American City Award was because of economic recovery.
Basically, yes.
Okay. And going back to its keeping it secret, the day before the earthquake, in reading your piece about the luxury of forgetting, there were two representatives going to Anchorage that were going to appear on the TV that night.
The mayor, Seward, and the city manager.
Yeah, to invite people to come. The following week was going to be a big celebration for receiving this award, right?
Right. The next weekend, the weekend after Easter, was going to be the big celebration.
So they're going out a day before the 64 earthquake to invite everybody to come and celebrate with us this All-American City Award.
Yeah, right. So they were gone you know, and so the acting mayor had to take over when the earthquake struck, and the civil defense moved into their operations quickly. And it didn't take long. One of the first major organizations to come in there was the Red Cross. Everybody remembers they were there. Eventually, the National Guard came in and other organizations came in. And it's amazing when you read how they recovered. Communication, as you can imagine, was a problem. How are we going to communicate? The radio station in Seward was gone.
I just want to step back. We get a number of people are not from Alaska. They're not familiar with the 64 earthquake. They're not familiar with the Iditarod. I mean, we got a lot of Chechakos that listen to our show. I want to step back just a little bit because 64 earthquake, I mean, the day before, it's business as usual. The 64 earthquake comes in, a 9.2. Give us a sense of the devastation has taken place because of this earthquake so people will get a sense of the recovery that had to take place.
Well, it was a long earthquake for earthquakes. Most of us here in Alaska have been involved in earthquakes. 15 seconds, 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds is a long earthquake. This one was somewhere between 3.5, 4 minutes. Some people say 5 minutes, but it was a long earthquake. It just kept going. So basically the damage, 12 people died, which is miraculous when you consider, but it was a Friday. It was Good Friday. Most people were at home. Few people were working because it happened at 5:36 p.m. Yeah. But the entire economic structure of Seward rested along the shoreline. Okay, that's where it was basically. I mean, there was the mercantile business operations in town, you know. But the money that really came in to the budget came in from the shoreline. 7 docks, including the Alaska Railroad dock, were destroyed. Alaska Railroad tracks were destroyed. Buildings, okay. A halibut cannery was destroyed. The small boat harbor was destroyed. 30 fishing vessels were destroyed. 40 pleasure craft were destroyed. 2 gantry cranes, there were 3 of them, one survived. 2 gantry cranes along the Alaska Railroad dock were destroyed. The basic fishing industry, which represented about 10% of the economy in Seward, the basic fishing industry was gone. Longshoring as a job occupation was pretty much gone. 3 houses burned by fire. 83 houses in Seward were unlivable. 260 homes were damaged. It represented about 15% of all the residency homes in Seward. Many public buildings were beyond repair, including the federal building, which is now the city hall. It's not the same building. It's a new city hall. Were unusable. You've got to imagine central water and sewer out. Telephone lines, communication lines were all gone. Wells were destroyed. Emergency generators. Seward had an emergency generator in case we lost power. That was gone. The radio station, KIBH radio, was out. All of that was gone quickly. I mean, within 5 minutes, it just disappeared. I mean, you imagine the shock of people.
Oh, and just so people know, 9.2. I was in that 7.2 that hit Anchorage, what, about 5 years ago, whatever it was. You couldn't stand up. And this 9.2, way bigger. And like you point out, for over 5 minutes.
Right.
The other thing that people will talk about are the aftershocks, which there were tons of them, and they were intense.
For weeks. And we haven't even talked about the tsunamis.
Yeah. The other thing was the oil tankers.
Texaco and Standard Oil had big oil tanks along the shoreline. As they started falling apart, the friction caused sparks, and they exploded. There was an 80-car train. Well, it was more than 80 cars, train on the tracks. The last 80 cars were filled with aviation fuel. And I found a letter where this is described. Once they caught on fire, it was like a chain reaction. Boom, boom, boom. Those cars just exploded along the track. The whole shoreline was on fire. Oil was on the water. The pilings from the piers were floating in the water like candles because the tops of them were burning. The Alaska Standard, which was an oil carrier, Standard Oil, they were offloading oil at the time of the earthquake. They managed to get out in the harbor. They radioed to the world, Seward is burning. The first message to the world was that the whole town had just been wiped out.
We were living in Texas at the time, and my cousins and aunt and uncle, he was a geologist in Alaska, in Anchorage, and that's the news reports we were getting at the time. How did it affect the sewage? How did it affect the water mains, everyday basic structure?
Within hours, civil defense came. And the first thing they did is, I mean, how are you going to communicate with everybody as to what to do? They got an old well, it wasn't old back then, mimeograph machine, you know, and they started producing bulletins with all kinds of information. And there were 9 bulletins published, some of them 2 or 3 pages within 5 days. Sometimes 2 or 3 bulletins came out in a day. What to do? Where to get your food? Don't drink the water. Don't flush the toilets. This is where you get your typhus shots. They had everything all figured out. The honey buckets came around. For those who don't know what the honey buckets are, for human waste, you know, they came around to collect the honey buckets a couple times a day.
Great name.
You know, all kinds of very specific information over a period of 5 days. They had a siren that would warn people if another tsunami was coming in. So they had that siren. But they also had church bells, too. They were used. The church bells were used to give signals to people as well. It's just amazing how they were able to do that and communicate and get so organized within a few days. The city hall had to move into the hospital. They got a group of women who knew everybody in town. And it was a committee of women. And their job was to find out who was still alive, who was missing, and who was dead. They knew everybody, so they knew how to do that. And over a period of a few days, it took them a few days to figure out where people were. Over the first day or two, they thought many, many people had died.
Were the tsunamis coming in at this time?
Yes. The first tsunami came in about 20 minutes after, and then there were a series of tsunamis. Now, what's interesting, I find out, when we talk about tsunamis, today, because of cell phones and iPhones, we know what tsunamis look like. Remember that first one? I think it was in the 90s in Indonesia that was broadcast all over the place. Now you can go to TikTok and Facebook and see a real tsunami. People used to think that a huge 50, 100-foot wave came in and smashed the town. No, a tsunami is a surge, right? It's a surge of water that just pushes its way in. I mean, I think the largest one that came in was about 40 feet of water.
Wow.
And the first one was 20 minutes later, and then a series of them came in. And that's where really most of the damage was done. And you can imagine all the damage that had been done during the quake itself got mixed up together. Railroad cars were lifted up and carried, you know, many, many feet. Boats in the harbor were carried. Vehicles were carried. There's one story. Some of my former students, knowing I'm working on this, sent me letters that hadn't been published before, at least to a lot of people, letters that had been written by their mothers during that time, talking about very interesting kinds of things about the tsunamis coming in and everything. So I had some new information that I could put in the article from that.
Yeah. Well, you're the kind of guy that you get a thread and you just write it out, man. I mean, you just keep pulling and it's like a pomegranate. You think you've spit out all the seeds, and then there's a whole new batch of them.
So no. In fact, two things that I've learned that I didn't really know before is when the earthquake struck at that time in Seward, the flu was going around in Seward. A lot of people had the flu.
Oh, God.
The letters talk about that. I mean, some people were sick, and they were trying to recover. The other thing, I didn't realize this, too. One woman wrote, after the first week was over, things are pretty much in control now, okay? So people can just sit down and take a breath. And you know what happened? She called it the earthquake blues. I call it post-traumatic stress. Imagine in that first week, you're just trying to recover. You don't have time to really think about too much. All of a sudden, you have to sit down and think. And you think about what happened to you, how you almost died, who did die. What are you going to do? Your house is gone. Your job is gone.
You're on adrenaline the whole time.
Yes.
And then on top of that, we go back to those aftershocks that you said went on for weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, you can never relax. You're just always on edge. How do I communicate to people outside who are worried about me?
Eventually, they said, people, write letters if you want. After a couple of days, write your letters and we'll get them out so you can let people know you're okay. You're all right. Talk about adrenaline. There's a story in there I tell about Donna Kowalski. At the moment the earthquake struck, she was making salmon cakes and she was cracking an egg. She had an egg in one hand and she was cracking an egg to go into, you know, her recipe for the salmon cakes. The earthquake struck. She went out in her car looking for the rest of her children, trying to gather her family together. Several hours later, she sees a light on in one of the houses. And this is several hours later. She goes into her friend's house And her friend says, oh, Donna, you look like, you know, you want a beer? You want to have a beer? Yeah, Donna said, I'll have a beer. So they sat down. She gives her a beer. And the woman says, Donna, you're going to crack that egg in the beer? She carried around an egg that she had had in her hand the moment the earthquake struck. She carried around with her for several hours while she was looking for her children. That's adrenaline where you're thinking about nothing else.
One of the family stories I came across was the McRae family.
Oh, yes.
Here's one family's experience, and just give us some of the little pieces about that.
Well, I think, first of all, I want to mention the important thing about this story is this was one of the first stories to go to the outside. Linda McRae, who's now Linda McSwain, was the one that they talked to. And she was a high school student at the time. And she told them the story. Basically, they weren't living in tsunami area at the time. When the earthquake struck, the family, it was seven adults, a three-week-old baby, and a dog. They went checking on other family members, okay? When checking on one of the other family members who lived right near the water, okay, they were checking on those family members, and they heard the sound, tsunami coming. So they climbed up, the seven adults with the little three-week-old baby and the dog climbed up on the garage roof. As soon as they got on the top there, they realized it wasn't going to be high enough, so they climbed up onto the roof. Well, the tsunami struck, okay, while they're up on the roof of this house, and it destroyed the garage they had been on. It picked the house up, okay, destroyed the bedrooms. They were just on top of the living room. Picked the house up for about 15 minutes. They're swirling around. Linda writes that they saw a dog on a mattress go by. They saw cars go floating by them as they're moving. They saw propane tanks floating away. And her father was really concerned they'd get hit by a propane tank. And
yeah.
Okay, so finally, it lodged. The house lodged between two trees in the woods. It stopped. Okay. Remember, there were a few more tsunamis that were going to come in. Now, when the earthquake struck, it was about 38 degrees outside. So the evening comes, it's going to get colder, too. They're all up there. They dug into the roof to get to the insulation, and the mother and the baby went down into the insulation to keep warm. They used the insulation to keep themselves warm. But at some point, Linda's feet were in the water up on the roof. She writes, and this is, I'm reading from, you have a copy of this. This is from a 10-year-old article in Alaska Magazine, March 2014, 10 years ago, it was written. She says, and talk about the humor of it too. She says, as a high school student, she said, as I left, Linda remembers, she said, I remembered grabbing what was really important to me, her prom dress, prom tickets, a new coat, records, and her boyfriend's class ring. I mean, the things that we think about at that time are very interesting.
Yeah.
The important thing about that story is that's the first story to get out to the press. And from that moment on, Seward became a focal point for the press.
When you're describing them on this house floating around and you see the dog and the mattress and the propane tanks and all this stuff, the image that comes to me is the scene in Wizard of Oz when she's in the tornado and all these things are flying by her. You're a journalist. You like the angles and stuff. I'm sure they jumped all over this once they grabbed a hold of this.
Right. I mean, you know, when you're assigned to do a story, you figure out, well, how am I going to cover it? What's the frame I'm going to use? What's the angle? What angle am I going to take? How am I going to present this? Well, first of all, you got to remember, the angle was already there before the earthquake. Here we get Seward recovery from its economic disaster, you know. So wonderful city, all the things that they did, the recovery that they made, and then the announcement that they're an all-American city on March 26 goes to the world. The next day, wham, it's all gone. As a reporter, you don't need an angle, right? No. You've got an angle.
Yeah.
Okay. And when the story about like McRae's hit, you know, press came to Seward and started getting all of these stories.
We ran out of time, but to hear the complete interview with Doug Capra, visit our website where you can find the podcast and be able to read his article at BigAlaskaShow.com. Finally, we like to close out our interviews with a gold nugget from the past with legendary broadcaster Herb Shainlin, who worked at this very station where we broadcast our show on KFQD. Herb was in the military and was on the air for the Armed Services Broadcasting Network.
I was on the air of the Armed Forces Radio at the moment. I sat there waiting and hoping for that needle to stop. And of course, it seemed like it never did. When it did, I got up and ran out of the studio, smack into a door that had been open 15 or 20 minutes before, and fell to the floor, owning a Class A uniform. I thought it would never stop working, and I couldn't leave because as long as you're on the air, you don't get up and walk out. But the room was shaking, the building was shaking, the town was shaking. Eventually, the needle stopped, and I got up and ran. I saw concrete buildings writhing as though they were serpents. I didn't know concrete buildings could do that. And it never occurred to me that this was an earthquake. I thought, because earthquakes were not in my frame of reference, I thought they had dropped the bomb. Not until after the whole thing was over and I had finished watching the buildings writhing and telephone poles snapping back and forth, the wires swaying, and I didn't see a mushroom cloud, so the only other thing that it could have been was an earthquake. I was kind of busy because Armed Forces Radio and Television is a pretty cushy job. And I figured the reason that I had benefited from all of this soft military service was because in the event of a problem, I was supposed to get that station back on the air and talk to the people. Don't forget, it was 5:36 p.m. Everybody in the station had gone Friday. Everybody in the station had gone home at 5, except for an Air Force sergeant, who once was an officer but had been passed over for promotion, so he'd been demoted to sergeant. So he wasn't too intrigued with the idea of doing his duty. But I figured we had to turn on that generator and get back on the air. Now, every time we had had a disaster drill at Armed Forces Radio, we had had to call the engineer to come in and start that generator, which was outside, just outside the studio, because it never started. So I said to the sergeant, look, let's try to start. You know darn well it's not going to start, and we don't have to go back in and broadcast. So we can at least say we tried. So we went over to the generator, and I pressed the red button, and it started like a Rolls Royce. Absolutely.
And that was our friend, the late Herb Shainlon, who would remain in Anchorage after his Air Force career to become a well-known flamboyant broadcaster in Alaska, both in radio and television. He also emceed the Polar Bear Jump-Off and Seward for the American Cancer Society. When his health began failing, he handed that honor to us on the Big Alaska Show, which is where the show started 18 years ago. So, that's our show. The 1964 Good Friday Alaska earthquake is a remarkable event. We need to remember the people in our two shows experienced something most of 8 billion that live on this planet never came close to experiencing. But to hear their accounts and record them for future generations, there's a satisfaction knowing that these stories will continue to be gold nugget memories and reminder of the Alaska spirit this show is all about. And to my baby girl, love you, and Mike Ford, why don't you take us out as you so eloquently do?
All right, Uncle Steve, we want to thank Doug for joining us. We want to thank you for listening. And we want to thank our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors, Alaska's window experts at 6251 Tuttle or online at neighborswindowsanddoors.com, and Alaska Enterprise Solutions. They're your authorized Xerox sales agent for Alaska. Visit them online at aesalaska.com. Remember, if it's Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and no good line through your two tall Alaska tales, it's got to be the Big Alaska Show. Have a great week, everybody.